Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Danny LaRue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. This is the Central Division Capsule Podcast, so the way those work is it is an off-season review and a regular season preview, and the guests for this episode are Sean Hyken of NBC Sports and Brian Schroeder of Hardwood Paroxysm and Bulls by the Horns. And so we talk about the teams that are in this division, who got better, who got worse, and also the, you know, what's coming in the season, a lot of Cavs and Bulls because they're the best teams. We hit everybody in some real substance, and the conversation itself runs for a little over an hour, and then both of them are very into jerseys, and we had this conversation actually at Summer League in a forum, and we ended up just talking about it, and I liked it enough to keep it on the podcast. So that runs about 20 minutes. So the whole thing I think is around an hour and a half, but there's about an hour five of the division capsule and then about 20, 25 minutes of jerseys and things like that. So if you like it, you can listen to that part too. I really enjoyed having it. So hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on. So I figure the best place to start with this is we'll do the off-season interview, and I guess start with Sean. Is in this division, who do you think got better and who do you think got worse?
Well, I mean, I think that the Cavs and the Bulls, who are the two best teams in the division, kind of stayed the same relatively. I mean, the Bulls definitely stayed the same. They drafted Bobby Portis, and other than that, their roster is literally the exact same. The Cavs, I guess, probably got a little bit better because of, you know, adding Mo Williams. I really like the Greg Monroe pickup for the Bucks. I think he's going to really help them. I think he's basically going to make it. Because, so, you know how, like, last year, Chris Middleton was basically their first option on offense. Now he's their third option if they have Monroe and they have Jabari healthy. So, you know, I think they're going to get a lot better just, you know, from having Monroe and from having Jabari back. Now, as far as who got worse, I mean, Indiana definitely got worse losing David West and Roy Hibbert. I still think they could be a fringe playoff team, but I really like the Monte Ellis signing for them, and I think we'll probably talk about that later because, Danny, I know you and I have talked about that before, and we don't really agree about that, but Indiana, I'm not sure if they got better. I think they probably got worse.
I think if anyone got worse, it was Indiana, but it was kind of necessary. And for Monte, the concept of Monte with Paul George makes a lot of sense because Paul George desperately needs, like, literally anyone else who can dribble. I mean, it could work. It might not. The Greg Monroe signing is a much better fit for Milwaukee, especially if he's a five, which he will be. He's a five. It's just that's why he's been kind of, I guess, his reputation's kind of taken a hit in the last couple of years because he's been playing power forward next to Drummond, and it just doesn't really work. It never looked like it worked. It never looked good. So Monroe isn't a good defender, but he's got good steal rates. And, you know, the Bucks force an ungodly amount of turnovers, so he fits right in there. He can just pop up when somebody runs into Giannis and just take the ball. Like, he'll be fine.
The thing with Monroe not being a good defender is that he's going to the one team that can hide that.
He's got good length, too.
You're going to put him next to John Henson, and you're going to put him next to Giannis if Giannis is playing some four or even some five. You know, you're going to put those guys who are much better defenders than him. And then on the perimeter, you've got Carter Williams. They've got guys who can defend, so you can just kind of hide Monroe's weakness.
And he's not Cantor. Like, he understands. He's just not a very good defender. He's not abysmal, or he's not so bad that he can't be played.
Well, and I think his help defense is going to be helped a lot by playing center most of the time, because the way that he moves within space, you know, he can use his, even if his instincts are the same, it is just physically less distance from him to the ball if he's closer to the rim than it was when he was playing power forward. And I like what Brian said, that his reputation did a disservice because he was playing out of position. And that happens a lot. I mean, you see a guy do something that was never supposed to work, and it didn't work, and then he gets hurt by it. And so I think that he is in the best circumstance, except that I don't think they have a great point guard. I've never been sold on Michael Carter Williams. Nope. I mean, he's not abysmal, but he's just, you know, he's substantially below league average, and he might not even be starter quality right now. He could eventually be. On Monte, like, I'm fine with the concept of Monte Ellis. You know, he's a talented guy. He likes having the ball in his hands. As you guys said, he's a secondary option. My issue with it is that they signed him for 4 years, and I could see the wheels coming off basically any point, because not only is he a guy who relies so heavily on his athleticism to get success offensively, he has a lot of miles on his tires. I was just talking on Twitter with Tim Kawakami, who covers the Warriors. We now were covering those teams when Monte was on team. And, like, there was a season, Keith Smart's season coaching the Warriors, where Monte played more than 40 minutes in 50 games, or 49 games in a single season. And so he has that kind of stuff there. So I worry that, like a lot of smaller, quicker guys, once he loses even half a step, that will be kind of devastating for him.
Yeah. If the years aren't great, and I'm not...
Like I said, I hardly think it'll be a great signing, but I understand why they looked out there and saw him, and I thought that he was the best option. But especially, they're trying to trim. The Pacers aren't trying to, you know, they're the Pacers. They are what they are. They're not trying to add too much salary most years.
Yeah, and they're also, like, they're not a team that gets free agency. You kind of have
no.
to.
Yeah.
You have to overpay. You have to offer more years than maybe you're comfortable with giving somebody. I'm sure they would have rather given Monte a 3-year deal or even a 2 with an option or something. But
if we're accounting for it just based on last year, obviously last year was non-representative for them. I'm trying to think of a team that went through a bigger identity shift than the Pacers, because they went from, you know, George Hill, David West, and Roy Hibbert to Paul George and George Hill and whatever else, like maybe Paul George at the 4. Like, their whole identity. Yeah, Miles Turner, their whole identity is totally different than it was a year ago.
Yeah.
Who's their starting center at this point? Is it Miles Turner?
I would say it's probably going to be Jan Mahinmi.
Yeah, probably Jan.
That is not...
Their front court rotation is just strange. There are guys that I'm okay with. I mean, if they start Jan Mahinmi and Jordan Hill, that's just going to be rough.
Oh, God, that's...
LaVoie Allen's going to get a lot of minutes for them, and he probably should compared to what else they have.
Yeah, I think they're top 1-4 is fine in terms of if they were all 3 and 4. You know, if they had two guys above them, like when they had West and Hibbert, they'd be fine. I like LaVoie. I like Miles Turner. I'm a huge Miles Turner guy. I think I had him 5th on my board. But he's going to take time. I mean, there are very few guys who are 19 years old who are gangbusters at center, especially if you're not, you know, Kareem. And Kareem didn't even come into the league until I think he was 22. But, yeah, I think that the Pacers are in a tough spot. But they also... They don't need to be great this year. I think if they can find themselves and maybe muddle a little bit, and, you know, let's say they end up with like the 10th best record, get another solid player, and then, I mean, it's not like Paul George is going to be a free agent next year. They have a little bit of time to figure this out.
Yeah,
I agree.
I don't want to talk about every move, but just a transaction that happened this summer, draft pick, trade, whatever, that you were particularly interested in.
Be honest, I'm not going to say Portis, even though you might assume I would, because Portis is going to be what he is, and it's fine. And he's not going to play very much to begin with. I'm very curious about Stanley Johnson, because I really wanted them to take Winslow, because I was very concerned about his finishing. He was not a very good finisher at the rim in college. And he looked great in summer league, but, I mean, he looked great in summer league. It's not always a great predictor for NBA success. But if he's huge, if he is what he looks like he might be, they look a lot different. Like, just compared 12 months ago, what the Pistons roster looked like and what it looks like now, and it looks, you know, 200% more like a Stan Van Gundy team, where they're going to be playing Ilyasova, Morris, Tolliver at the 4 pretty much at all times. They'll have someone capable of shooting, and they'll have whatever Johnson can do. They'll have 2-point guards. Hopefully one of them works. That's a little risky, but... Yeah, I'm interested in what Stanley Johnson will be, maybe not this year, but next year, because he's a gigantic human being, and he looked like a monster in some way.
Yeah, I'm really interested in what the Pistons are doing, too, but I think the most interesting move that I think, and like, I really like what we were just talking about, how we really like a lot of what the Bucks did. I do not understand why they let Jared Dudley go. Why they just gave him away for nothing. Because that's a guy they could use. He was useful for them last year.
They might be concerned about his health.
If they're concerned about his health, I can see that. But he just opted in for like $6 million. Like if he's not good, you can flip him at the deadline, and it's not like you're gonna get less for him at the deadline than
all they got was a trade exception at a number that's gonna be a really low value trade exception in the future. You know, this isn't a circumstance where you can fit a bunch of guys into that. There aren't many players making less than $6 million. The teams are like, hey, you want to take this guy? Especially now they created two of those exceptions because they did the same thing with Zaza Pachulia. Yeah, for me, the Bucks, they did the big things really, really, really well. You know, I think the Chris Middleton contract is a bargain. He's a good player, and he took a lot less than he probably could have gotten. He could have gotten the same amount of money for 4 years. Instead, he got it for 5. And that's very useful. You know, it's very useful for the Bucks. And the other one with that is Greg Monroe signing a 2-year contract with a player option is really fascinating because it's a bet on himself. But at the same time, it makes complete sense with how the league is going. And so he gets another bite at the free agency apple really soon.
Mm-hmm.
But then they got the you talked about the idea of dumping Jared Dudley. They also dumped Zaza Pachulia, and they gave up a first round pick for Grievous Vasquez, who's a free agent at the end of the year. It's like
I don't hate that as much.
Ugh, I hate that.
It's just a confusing series of moves that don't really. You're this young team on the rise, and you're just sort of shedding off useful depth pieces for nothing, basically, and then overpaying for Grievous, who I like, but.
Yeah, I like him too. If he were in the last year of his rookie contract and he was a restricted free agent next summer, I wouldn't love the deal, but I'd be broadly okay with it. You know, it's kind of one of those.
It is confusing that they had to pay a first round pick for Grievous Vasquez, but they got nothing for Jared Dudley and Zaza. And I think they're probably both better players than Grievous is.
Yeah,
especially in this system, Zaza was weirdly the same, very similar percentages to Greg Monroe, steal percentages, rebound percentages. Assist percentages to Greg Monroe's career. So maybe that's, I mean, you don't really need him if you have Monroe. They do duplicate each other to an extent, but
well, yeah, it kind of felt like they did those moves preemptively. Like the assumption was, oh, those guys are going to be unhappy, so we might as well move them now.
Yeah.
But you never know, you know, heaven forbid, in training camp, you know, Greg Monroe tweaks his knee or, you know, Giannis does some, you know, any of those guys, those depth pieces, if the Bucks, and it sounds like they want to compete for the playoffs, having more guys, having more dudes is better, especially in this case, when you're not getting anything for them. You know, if they got a first round pick or even like a really high second for one of those guys, then, you know, maybe you want to strike while the iron's hot. But if all you're functionally getting is a trade exception, then you're going to have that available later.
Mm-hmm. Do they really think Rashad Vaughn's going to play a lot this year? I mean, I can't imagine.
Yeah,
they have no other shooters, really. They have Middleton.
And O.J. Mayo. And
Mayo.
And Bayless, I guess. The strangest thing about that team is you think about how they have so many guys that they traded two players to squeeze out, and if everybody stayed healthy, it wouldn't hurt their bottom line too much. But they still have so many dudes. It's just a crazy team. Yeah. So I think it's kind of an easy answer with this one, but who do you guys think is going to be the best newcomer? So that, it can be a rookie or it can be a veteran, but just the best player on their team who wasn't on that team last year.
I mean, it's Greg Monroe, right?
I think it has to be.
Yeah, pretty much. Unless Stanley Johnson is amazing. Well, even then, I doubt it.
Yeah. And then, so that moves fast. We talked about this a little bit, but I think there are a couple of really fun choices for the rookie. I guess we'll start with Sean. The rookie you're most excited to see this year.
Bobby Portis. I don't know how much he's even going to play this year because the Bulls have such a crowded front court. But there's also, you know, the thing is that, you know, we say that they have this crowded front court, but, you know, you have to keep in mind, I think there are going to be maybe more minutes for him than people think because you have to keep in mind Taj Gibson is coming off of ankle surgery. You know, we don't know what he's going to be in terms of health-wise for training camp. Pau is 35. He's going to – I would assume he's not going to play as many minutes as he did under Tibbs. And I think the same thing is true with Noah. He might get some days off here and there, even though he's not coming off knee surgery this summer like he was last summer or, like, have a strict minutes limit. And I actually was at a charity thing he did last month, and he said that he wasn't going to have any kind of minutes limit. But I would imagine Fred Hoiberg is probably going to try to make an effort to limit his minutes and maybe not play him 40 minutes a game, given the way his health was. So I think Portis might have some opportunities. And I think I mean, based on what we saw at Summer League, which, you know, obviously that's not really a huge indicator of anything, but, you know, for a big guy that can shoot, the thing to me with Portis is he doesn't take anything off the table. There's nothing he's bad at. There's nothing you can put him on out on the floor, and then suddenly you have a problem in one area. He's at least okay at everything, and that's...
He's probably the best ball handler, aside from Mirotić. He's the best ball handler who could conceivably play center for Hoiberg, and I think that could help. Like, Hoiberg does... His system does seem to be predicated on that, so that might help him get some minutes. I just don't think he will to start, not even because of the Bulls' franchise philosophical nature, whatever they do with their... Sorry.
Well, is that a Tibbs thing, or is that a Bulls thing?
It's kind of a Bulls thing. I think it's more that Mirotić is going to play a lot for Hoiberg. Yeah. And that he might be reticent to play Portis at the five to start, even though he's gigantic. But
But what also makes Portis such a fascinating part of this Bulls kind of overall team is the idea of that his performance both in games and in practices affects the way that they think about their composition moving forward. I mean, Noah's a free agent at the end of this upcoming season. Gasol will presumably opt out. Taj, you know, we never really know what he's going to do. So an emergent Portis, whether that be in games or in practices, you know, if he has a great October, I think they get substantially more open to doing some more things, and that's why he looms large in it. But the guy for me is Miles Turner, because not only is he going to get an opportunity to play, but I think there's a lot more that we don't know. Like, I think Portis, you know, he's a great effort guy. I mean, that through the 3-point shot he showed in that I think it was against the Knicks in that one summer league game, that was just we were all just sitting there going, wait, what? Like, so he has that, but Turner is so much more of an open question that I'm excited about that, and because there is so much more room for the Pacers to, I don't want to say grow, because the Bulls are a better team by a large margin. The Bulls, you know, if everything works out, they can be a contender in the East. But the Pacers are much more of a tabula rasa, so if he can be good, then you start to think about where they're going in a very different way, whereas I feel like the Bulls are the Bulls to a point.
Although we don't know exactly what they are under Hoiberg, but, you know, yeah, they're the Bulls.
In terms of their roster, yeah, it's literally the exact same team as they had last year plus Portis.
But it might, you know, the minutes distribution might be different. Hoiberg might realize that Etuan Moore is probably a better basketball player than Kirk Heinrich, which is a very sad sentence. I just play him more.
Well, I will say this. At Fred's introductory press conference back at the beginning of June when they first hired him, he went through everybody on the roster and said how he thinks they're going to help the team. And he even mentioned Etuan Moore. Like, he said, yeah, Etuan had a good year. He had some big games. You know, he's going to get some minutes. You know, he just said just generic stuff like that. He didn't mention Kirk at all.
Yeah.
So that makes me think he's maybe not going to have the same attachment to playing him that Tom Thibodeau did.
And now John Paxson will fight a third head coach.
Yeah, and it feels like, I don't know, what goes against that is that they didn't really commit the resources, despite choosing to be a tax team, which was very encouraging because, you know, they retained Dunleavy. They had a better offseason than I expected. But that the fact that they're walking into a season with Aaron Brooks as their backup point guard for Derrick Rose is a little bit scary when you're talking about, I think the Bulls have the best shot of knocking off the Cavs conceptually in a 7-game Eastern Conference series of the East teams, of course, limiting it to that. But that is the huge red flag, because if Derrick Rose misses time, they're just dead.
I was baffled by them not getting a better backup point guard this offseason. Out of the guys that were available, I think, you know, originally I thought the best target for them would have been Corey Joseph, but then obviously Toronto gave him more money than the Bulls could have, because they only had the taxpayer mid-level exception. Then you look at Jeremy Lin got, and I don't even think Jeremy Lin is that good, but you look at Jeremy Lin getting, what did he get, $2 million from the Hornets?
Yeah, and he
got... The Bulls could have afforded that, and I don't think Jeremy Lin is that great, but he's a hell of a lot better than what Aaron Brooks was last year.
And you have to assume the visibility of, assuming he was going to be the backup both places, which is true, he might play a little bit more in Charlotte, but the visibility of being on the Bulls, this is something that Jeremy Lin, of all people, should appreciate, that role plus visibility helps. If for whatever reason your market is lower than it should be, then if you're going to bet on yourself, you do something like what Ed Davis did last year, where you go to a very visible team, and then somebody will pay you.
Brooks was just miserable in the playoffs last year. Just from every possible metric, he was horrible. Well, let's just go with that again. That'll work. Yeah, sure.
We didn't really talk about it because they didn't fit within this rubric, but I think that Cleveland, so far, there's, of course, a huge caveat left because of Tristan still being out there, but they had an incredibly successful offseason. Like, if you think about what their goals were, I mean, LeBron is LeBron, but they got Kevin Love to functionally agree to the longest contract he was ever going to agree to. Mm-hmm. And they got an upgrade at backup point guard without losing their then backup point guard, who will also make his money in jersey sales, and then they got J.R. Smith to take a discount, for whatever, you know, because he was aggressive, and so I think that you can say realistically that things worked out about as well for them as you could expect, with the huge thing being we don't know about Tristan.
Yeah.
I still think Tristan's going to get maxed out before training camp.
I don't know what else could happen, honestly.
Well, I mean, maybe he signs the, like, he could sign the qualifying offer, and if he does that, then, you know, his agent has already said on the record that if he signs the qualifying offer, he's not going to stay in Cleveland. So, he can get more money next year with the salary cap going up. So, I mean, I get that, but I don't know if Tristan, like, it's one of those things where I don't know if Tristan Thompson is a max player in a vacuum, but for the Cavs, I think he absolutely is, and they need
him. Draymond Green corollary?
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's the Draymond Green corollary, but even stronger, because there is zero chance the Cavs are going to have cap space in the next few years. As long as you assume they're going to have LeBron James, they have money now committed for the next four seasons. If you count LeBron as a fait accompli, regardless of him having a contract or not, which I think is fair, you have Kevin Love, Kyrie Irving, and LeBron James under contract. Even with the exploding cap, you're not going to have space. And when you factor in that Mozgov presumably is going to be in the same boat as Tristan, then why not pay him? What is the point of playing hardball for a couple million dollars when you can't replace him and he's represented by LeBron's guy? And so just make everybody happy. I mean, considering the, like, you can just say, hey, the savings we got on J.R. Smith for him being silly and opting out of money, you know, the savings we got on him, we used part of that for Tristan Thompson, and that gets you part of the way. It doesn't get you the whole way, of course, but I mean, the money they saved on, and also they got Shumpert back at a reasonable rate, you know, maybe a little bit higher, but that's exactly the same circumstance. They realized, you know, it's like, we might as well just pay this guy because we have no other ways to get better anymore.
Yeah. Right, and like, and my thing is, like, I know it's going to be a ton of luxury tax money for Dan Gilbert this year, but then, you know, the cap is going to go up $20 million in each of the next two seasons, so it's really not going to be that much of a long-term hit. Like, I don't know if they're even in danger of paying the repeater tax. Yeah, you probably know more about their long-term, you know, cap situation than I do, Danny. But it seems like it's really just sort of a short-term hit if they were going to take the luxury tax hit of paying Tristan Thompson a max deal. It seems like something that's only going to be in effect for this year. And it's like you have a team that's probably
injuries away from really contending for a title versus
versus
one of the best regular season teams of the last 20 years. I mean,
here's the thing. I think that the Cavs are the prohibitive favorite to win the East. I think that's not really even up for dispute. And that, I mean, the fact is, think about all the stuff that went wrong for them last year with, like, LeBron and David Blatt not being on the same page. They had to make those two trades and, like, adjust, you know, bring in two new guys that actually
LeBron not playing for 2 weeks.
LeBron decided not to play for 2 weeks. You know, the Kevin Love gets injured in the playoffs. Kyrie is basically playing, even before the injury in the finals, Kyrie was basically playing on one foot for the entire playoffs, and then he has the knee injury. Even with all that stuff, they still made the finals pretty easily. Like, I mean, Chicago was a little bit more competitive with them, but they swept Atlanta, they swept Boston. You know, with all that stuff, they still, like, their path to the finals was still pretty painless.
And the top, of the East didn't get better.
Right, the top of the East, there's no team in the East. I think, you know, and I was thinking about this because we're doing a thing for Pro Basketball Talk for next week about, like, which, you know, who's the second best team in the East. And I had to think about it because there's no clear – last year, like, before the start of the season, it was clearly, you know, the conventional wisdom was, you know, it's Cleveland and Chicago that are the two best teams. And obviously Atlanta kind of came out of nowhere and did a lot better than anybody thought they were. But now it's like you've got a whole bunch of teams in, like, that second tier. You know, Chicago's in there, Miami's in there if everybody's healthy, Washington's in there, Atlanta is still in there. I think they got a little bit worse because they lost Damari, but I still think they're going to be pretty good. But all those teams, I think, are in their own tier that's pretty significantly below what the Cavs are. So if they have just any bit less injury stuff than they had last year, like, I don't see how they
just stroll. Yeah, those strolls of the finals.
Well, that was the question I asked when I had Robbie Callen and Mike Prada on. We were talking about the kind of the question I like to use, and Robbie got a little bit sad because it was kind of a dig at the Hawks to a point,
right,
which is, if you exclude LeBron, how many starters do the Cavs have to lose to not be the favorites in the East?
I think you have to lose
LeBron.
I think, well, okay, so if LeBron's healthy, clearly they can make the finals without Love and functionally without Kyrie Irving. I think if they lost Mozgov, that would be a big problem.
Yeah, I think the answer is three. I, as crazy as it sounds, I think that they have to lose three starters if we're counting LeBron as a given, because I think otherwise then things get really complicated.
Right, if the Cavs lose LeBron, then, you know, all bets are off.
I honestly think they have LeBron, they'll still make the finals unless something crazy happens.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's what it takes. Is LeBron to break his spine or something.
Oh, and to answer Sean's question about Cleveland's cap situation, assuming LeBron gets his maximum every year, but they don't change the max structure, they could potentially not pay the tax in 2017-18. You know, if they are reasonable with the contracts they give to Mozgov and Thompson, they could, and everybody else, that year, they could potentially not pay the tax.
Yeah, and so I just don't understand why they're dragging their feet on Tristan, because I mean they need to keep him.
Yeah,
like because they have no way to replace him, and they need him. They need what he gives them, even if he's not going to be a starter for them with Kevin Love is healthy.
And honestly, if the margin between paying the tax and not paying the tax was LeBron, like let's say like I would assume he might be willing to take a small to you know take like $1 million less or something to like what Dwayne Wade did, you know, to a point just to even though it's obviously Dan Kilbert's probably still not his favorite person in the world. Also, if they've won a title by then I think Dan Gilbert has no right to complain that the bill is high or whatever.
He probably will, but yeah.
Right, because then Dan Gilbert is a hero in Cleveland forever.
Right. Yeah, and that's a huge component.
Sort of. What fresh hell is this?
So one of the ways that I've there are a lot of people, and I've been talking about this for because really this is the only topic to talk about in the East if we're fixating on the title is how does the Cavs being prohibitive favorites to make the finals in your mind affect their likelihood of winning the finals? I think they're good enough that they have a better than puncher's chance, notably better if they're even close to healthy, against anybody. So I think that makes them have a much better shot at the title than maybe some people are saying, just because there's so many less ways for them to fail. The one way for them to fail is to lose in the finals.
Yeah, I
think they're probably the favorites to win the title at this point. Because there's so many more moving parts in the West. There's like five teams at the top of my head. I mean, depending on what you want to count.
Yeah, if you're taking the Cavs versus any single team in the West, they definitely have better odds. The Cavs versus the entire West, I still say that the West probably has a better chance.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But if you look at the West,
I don't know which team to take out of that.
The five teams in the West that are for sure title contenders, you know, you got Golden State, San Antonio, Oklahoma City, Clippers, and Houston, and then you know, depending on if you think Memphis is in there too, you know, that's five or six teams that
I think Memphis should be in there, but I'm not entirely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's reasonable to think Memphis will be competitive there. So you've got six teams right there, but like you know there's also you know the thing of like those teams might all just beat each other up in the playoffs, whereas the Cavs, you know, depending on who they face, I think they're going to win the East pretty easily, but they're going to have a lot less, you know, serious competition and serious, you know, teams that have serious chances of taking them out than any team in the West. There's no clear-cut favorite in the West.
How cold-blooded would it be if the Cavs were able to strategically rest guys during the Eastern Conference playoffs?
Oh my God, that would. Yeah, I mean, it's possible.
I mean, it's also possible that they could be ahead in their series enough that they could just say, "Oh, well, we'll just try to win in five," and then you get the rest anyway. But
yeah,
there's I mean, so
that'd be more what LeBron would do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that is the kind of the biggest story to me of the Cavs season is there any reason to play him in the regular season more than like 30 minutes a game?
No, there's not.
Yeah, I think you play him 30 minutes a game, and I think you play him like 70 games, assuming he's healthy, because they're going to have the East locked up in terms of record pretty early, because even the teams like the Bulls that are good are having a huge adjustment period, and everybody in the conference and pretty much in the league, the bottom got a lot better. So I think that teams like the Hawks and the Bulls are going to just lose more games because they'll, you know, they won't have as many games where they're just way better. So if they have, you know, like a 10 game lead going into the middle of March, they should just sit all their guys.
Yeah. I agree.
They could, you know, play them lightly, but they can ramp their guys up during the playoffs as opposed to ramping them up to the playoffs. Like, it's such a crazy thing because I don't think we've ever seen it where a team could basically figure themselves out. They could, and, you know, people talk about how you have to turn on your light switch at various moments. They could turn on their light switch in the conference semifinals, and I think they'd be fine.
Probably, yeah.
That's scary.
I think the Spurs in the mid-2000s did. Could have done that to an extent.
That's an interesting parallel. Yeah, that might be true.
Because when it was still a 5-game first round series, they didn't care. They would waltz past people, and they'd be playing Duncan. That's when they started playing Duncan like 30 minutes a game, maybe 2006 or 7. And then, you know, I mean, that didn't hurt them then. They cruised through the finals in 07, so.
Yeah, the only reason the Cavs would push hard is if it was important to them to have the best record or to jump some teams in terms of the finals, but I don't think that's a big enough deal.
I'm not sure they're that convinced. They're that dependent on home court anyway. They might say they are, but I'm not sure that they are.
Well, yeah, especially when the it's just the finals. You know, they should be the favorites to have it the rest of the way. So really, that's, you know, a game 7 in the finals, which is clearly important. I mean, I'm not going to discount the importance of a conceptual finals game 7. But especially when they switched it back to the 2-2-1-1-1, being the home seed doesn't matter as much the rest of the way. We'll move on to the season preview. Obviously, we can talk about if we have more on those notes, but just simply ranking the teams 1-5.
Cavs, Bulls, Bucks, Pistons, Pacers.
Interesting. Okay.
Drummond's too good. Drummond's the best player.
Yeah, I mean, I think the top three in that order is pretty hard to argue with Cavs and then Bulls and then Bucks. I kind of lean towards putting the Pacers.
Yeah, that was a knee-jerk reaction.
Right. I kind of lean towards that just because I think Paul George is going to have a really big year. Coming back from the injury, he seems like he's, you know, if he's healthy, if he's moving well, you know, I think people are kind of forgetting how good he was before the injury, and I think he's going to be able to come back from that. I guess I just have a lot of faith in him to do that. And I don't know. It's interesting, but I agree about Drummond, and I think Drummond is just going to have a
blast. My question is when will he get All-Star consideration? He's probably deserved it the last 2 years.
Drummond?
Yeah.
Well, the crop of guys he's competing with in the East is probably thinner. But it's hard because I think he'll have to get in on coach's vote. You know, I don't think the Pistons are going to hit that level. Even because he's had the Sports Center plays the last couple of years. He's had the Moses Malone stats the last couple of years. So that wasn't enough. In terms of the coaches, I think that he'll have a respectable chance. But why I'm leaning Pacers over Pistons is, first of all, I think they're both good coaches, and so Stan Van, I think, is a better regular season coach than Vogel, though Vogel has done a very good job. I just have more faith that Stan can do it with less talent because he's done it before. Mm-hmm. But then I think there's a substantially greater chance that Paul George is a top 10, top 15 player in the league this year than Drummond because Paul George has already done it. So I think the surrounding talent, I think the overall package in Detroit makes a whole lot more sense, especially with their coach. But having a player, you know, that's in that conversation can win you a lot of games.
Yeah.
So, but that it ties in kind of in an interesting way to the next question, which is, how many teams in this division do you think make the playoffs?
Three.
Well, three for sure, I think.
I think three, but it would be hard. Four would be eminently possible, but I think it's very possible.
I think. Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing. There's going to be two playoff spots open because if you think Cleveland, Chicago, and Milwaukee make it from the Central, and I realize they don't do the whole division thing anymore, but then I was listening to the podcast that you did with Tim a while ago, and Tim and Jared Weiss that was talking about like whether the Atlantic Division was going to get shut out. I don't think it's going to, but you know, you've basically got Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee from the Central, and then you've got Atlanta, Miami, presumably if they're healthy, and Washington from the Southeast. So that's only two spots open, and you know, then you've got Toronto, Boston, Indy, and Detroit. I think are the four teams that have the best chance, but that's four teams fighting for two spots. It could be Toronto and Boston, or it could be. It could be two teams from one of the other divisions. Like there's so many variables. Like I think it's possible that the rest of the Central Division could get shut out. It's also possible that all five teams get in the playoffs. I don't think it's likely, but it's possible.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit different. I said in the Southeast one that the reason I like three as a number for that is that I thought that there would be a possibility that if one of the teams fell out, that a team from that division would go in. But to me, it's harder. I think it's three with the Central, but not for that logic, because I feel much more comfortable in all three Central teams making it, because we already saw Milwaukee make the playoffs with a rookie head coach with one of their best players out for the whole year. So it wasn't
and with completely changing their roster. They traded one of their best players at the trade deadline for a point guard who can't shoot.
Correct. Yeah, they did for a point guard who can't shoot, and they added Greg Monroe, who's an upgrade over Zaza Pachulia, even though Zaza Pachulia played surprisingly well last year. And so I think that the Bucks, while of course it's possible that they don't make playoffs, I mean, they also had a positive point differential last year, which wasn't super common in the East. I mean, the only team that didn't make the playoffs who did was the Pacers, and they were obviously a very different circumstance.
Pacers were also very close to the playoffs.
Yeah, they were. They were about as close as you could.
Still so upset about that.
I was going to say as close as you could get, but I think the Thunder get that honor. So then the only other question, obviously we can talk about other things if you want, though, is what players do you think, and we can talk about some, let's focus more on the players we haven't talked about as much, though I'm sure a guy like Drummond will come up. What players do you think from this division will break out, like reach a different level of success or fame this year?
Well, I think the obvious choice is Mirotić.
I was going to say, I don't think Jimmy Butler can get any higher, but I mean, he's still here.
He's still there. I agree. I think Mirotić is going to have a huge year under Hoiberg. I think Hoiberg's offense is a lot more suited to what Mirotić does than Tibbs was. You know, you're going to see a lot. I want to ask you guys how you guys feel about Doug McDermott on that same note.
I was going to say earlier, does he count as a rookie, honestly? Like, he almost should.
Well, except that he was a four-year college player. I mean, it's not like it's not like a Dante Exum situation, let's say, where it's this super young kid who came over and basically had to spend a year. He was a player who played in the United States, who played for 4 years of college. McDermott worries me because he hasn't been reliably good at what we thought he would be good at.
Yeah.
And that goes two directions. So part of me, when it's somebody who I'm really confident in that skill, I go, oh, well, they'll work that out. Like, theoretically, let's say if, like, Stephen Curry had a bad rookie year shooting-wise, I'd be like, okay, well, he's still a good shooter. I believe in it. With McDermott, I'm a little bit less confident in that. However, he's not going to be asked to do a lot for the Bulls. This isn't a circumstance where, you know, you're like, hey, shoulder the load on the offense, even though their second unit is not strong in terms of perimeter depth. But I worry that he also, I would be intrigued with him as a small ball four, just offensively, just doing that. But there is no conceivable way other than like dysentery to their entire team that he is deserving of minutes at the big man positions because they just have, they have more talent. You know, like they have so much talent that for weird reasons, I feel like I'll end up seeing Bobby Portis the three for very short periods of time, which would be awesome, by the way.
That'd be interesting, because they tried that with Mirotić, and it didn't really work that well.
Yeah. Mirotić can't defend threes. I mean, that's the problem there. Is offensively, you know, if you want to build an offensive role for him that is similar to a small forward, I think you can make that work, but he can't defend them at all.
The funny thing here is that I distinctly remember him guarding Paul Pierce fairly well when he was at the three.
Mirotić?
Yeah, but, you know, Paul Pierce isn't a three, so.
Yeah, Paul, that's right. Paul Pierce is a four at this point in his career.
But they were both playing three for some reason in the game.
Yeah. I also feel like there is a chance that a lot of guys, there's so many guys in this conference, in this division particularly, who I like more than it feels like the casual fan, not necessarily more than, you know, people like us, but like Drummond, Chris Middleton, maybe Amon Shumpert, but he's not flashy, but they're like guys who can do well. And also, we've talked about it a little bit before, but I think that fans are going to rediscover how good Paul George is because he was incredible. Yeah. He was good for a couple of years before everything happened, but he's a great defensive player. He's one of the best perimeter defenders in the league. But his offense grew leaps and bounds before he got hurt, and assuming he can come back with most of that, I feel pretty optimistic that he can play a substantially positive role on that team, even if they're not dominant in any way.
Yeah, jumping back really quick, I think Middleton's a good answer for not necessarily a player who will break out, but a player who will sort of solidify his position, because I feel like even going through the playoffs, a lot of people kind of saw him as just sort of their desperation offense, and they built their entire offense around him for most of the second half of the season. He was very good. Just got too fast of a release, and he's too tall not to be a good shooter for a long time. and he's a good defender. So I feel like he's not going to be even, like, borderline all-star level, honestly, but I feel like he's going to cement himself. Because you still saw people questioning if he was worth the money he got this year, and it just seems insane to me. Like, he's very good. He should be getting that, at least. He should be starting. I feel like maybe he'll, instead of breaking out, you know, become a star, he'll just solidify himself in that very good category.
I really hope also that this division has some guys like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope that I've liked in other years and just hope that they get a shot. And it would be nice to see, you know, McDermott, I think, is in that same camp of guys who, you know, have a chance to still show it, but they haven't yet.
Well, KCP's gotten a shot. He's gotten many, many, many shots, as many shots as he wanted.
Yeah, but on a bad team.
Yeah, I know, but he is not afraid to shoot.
I think with him that there are a group of guys, and incidentally, like half of the Warriors would be on this list, that I think they are substantially better players when their surrounding talent is there. Like, obviously, that's true of almost everybody, that they are helped by that. But I think if you are more a supporting player by nature, I feel like that amplifies in that. So when you're asked to do less, I think of a guy like Danny Green. Like, Danny Yeah. Green is asked to do very little, and he is awesome at it. And a guy like KCP could be in that kind of a role. And the Pistons aren't all the way there yet, but they're a whole heck of a lot closer than they were before.
Like I said, their roster, compared to this time last year, is night and day as far as what you'd want for a Stan Gundy team.
Yeah, Ilias, another guy who could have a really nice season is Ilyasova.
Mm-hmm.
People have talked. When the trade happened, I was sitting next to Sean in the finals, you know, in the media room, and I was thinking about it in terms of, oh, you know, it's kind of a 1 year thing, but he has a what is pretty much a non guaranteed contract for next year. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see the Pistons pick that up.
No,
yeah. I mean they can use him the way that Stan used Ryan Anderson in Orlando. Like yeah. He's exactly the same type of skill set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish they had a couple more guys. Like if Stanley can play the four, that would kind of do that. Like just a couple more players that I felt confident in. But Stan has developed them before. You know, this isn't a circumstance where you know you have an unproven head coach. Like if they can get one more, like two or three or something like that, or if Jennings can be healthy eventually during the season, so they can get 48 quality minutes from the one. I think that they could be better than people think. Being better than people think doesn't make them a playoff team necessarily, but I think they could be not only watchable, but actually, you know, one of those teams, like kind of a weird parallel to the pre-explosion Sacramento Kings, where they might not be better than everybody, but they can give everybody a game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a lot more watchable than they were last
year. Colliver's going to play a lot for them, and it's going to be hard for somebody to knock him out of that second or third spot.
Oh, Stan's going to love him, too. Well, he already
played He already does. He played him a lot last year.
Yeah, I feel like that you're right that he could be their Kirk Heinrich.
Yeah.
But he's better.
No, Colliver's fine. I've always thought he's been pretty good. It's just, he's weird. He has a weird frame. He's not that big, but he can shoot.
So I'll end this.
Plays hard.
Maybe not end it, but I'll ask you guys, I've been doing this on the other East podcast of this ilk. What team in the East do you think has the best chance of beating Cleveland in a 7-game series?
Probably Chicago.
You would think. If Noah has a better year than last year, if Rose can stay more consistently healthy, you know, I think those are still the two keys. I'm not really that worried about Hoiberg's offense because I think that's going to click pretty easily. And it would help if like Tony Snell and Doug McDermott and some of these guys, you know, some of their younger guys develop. But it really comes down to is Rose healthy and is Noah healthy? And those, you know, that's the whole like if those two guys are healthy, and that's a huge if. But, you know, I think they're probably the best team in the East besides Cleveland.
Feels like the seventh or eighth straight year, that's the kind of consensus that the Bulls are the best chance to take out LeBron's team. But, yeah, I mean, it still has to be, especially in this division. It's just by default.
I think a healthy Miami team would be there. It just feels so prohibitively unlikely that we get to see it. Because they also, I mean, Chicago has Jimmy Butler, who's a very good man-to-man defender, and Miami doesn't really have that guy. But Miami's strengths.
Not anymore.
Yeah, Miami's guys, their strengths are so good that I could see them working relatively well especially if Whiteside can deliver. Like, I feel like they can do certain things that Cleveland would just struggle with. But it's so unlikely that we get to see that, sadly enough, because there's so many injury risks on that team.
Dragic and Whiteside together.
Well, I mean, the thing with so Miami is you have to already, like, before you even do anything, you have to fold in at least 20 games that Dwayne Wade is going to miss.
Yeah, but let's say they're healthy going into the playoffs. Like, let's say going into a second-round series. Like, if Miami gets the 5 seed and they win their first-round matchup against whoever, I think that would be a really competitive 1-4, 1-5 series.
Yeah.
It would.
I mean, Wade would be motivated. So
yeah,
absolutely.
And Bosch too.
Yep.
And Miami can go. They can go smaller. You know, like they can play Bosch at the 5, which isn't small because Bosch is still a big dude. Or they can play, you know, more traditional, and they can do well either way, which is a nice thing to be able to do against Cleveland, because we still don't exactly know what they want to be at full strength, because we just never really got to see last year.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever fully incorporated their talent. That's just
they didn't, and they were such a different team. And I mean, a lot of this was out of necessity, but they became such a slow it down, like grind it out defensive team after they lost Love and Kyrie, and they did that out of necessity. But so it's like, I think you have to wonder, are they going to be able to keep a lot of those elements while also playing to what Love and Kyrie are good at? I don't know.
This is all speculated that Kyrie plays at all in 2015.
Oh, he will. Oh, you mean in this season?
In the calendar year.
Oh, well, I don't think they need him to play at all in the calendar year to be prohibitive to have a great odds of having the number one.
Well, I'm just saying it'll we won't know exactly how they'll integrate all the pieces.
That's a great point. Yeah, and also that means that, though I don't expect them to be a large factor in this, but that it really does affect if they're trying to make any moves at the deadline, that they will have a much less time to figure it out.
Yeah.
But it could be great for Kevin Love just to really kind of solidify his rapport with LeBron and really figure out space on the floor and how he can succeed and thrive on this team.
Coming back really quick to Miami, I do think they don't have a high-level man-to-man defender anymore, but they might. We don't know. Maybe Justice Winslow is always awesome.
Yeah, he could.
He has a profile for it.
Usually...
I'd be more confident in his defensive skills this year than his offensive skills.
Oh, for sure. I think that's true of just about any guy, especially if they don't have to play center, because centers have a big adjustment just realizing how fast everybody else moves. But
yeah.
It's always hard for a rookie to be a defensive ace. I mean, even players like Tony Allen, who ended up being very good defenders, struggled. Iguodala was good, but he wasn't, you know, Iguodala his rookie year. But he doesn't have to be that his rookie year. If he can figure it out by mid-April, late April, that could be enough.
Miami's just an interesting team, because they could, if at any point they need to, they can just switch it up and let Dragic run with Winslow and with everyone else.
I think they're going to run a lot.
Yeah, but if they have to, if they absolutely have to, they can just switch it to that gear, and Dragic can handle that as well as anyone in the league.
Yeah.
He's just a fun point guard. He's fun. It's fun to match him up against people, because he's just very unorthodox.
Well, and they have bigs that make a lot of sense with him. You know, yeah. But Bosch and Whiteside.
He and Whiteside could just wreck the Cavs in a playoff series. Maybe not for the entire series, but
definitely take a couple games. That would be a series.
Yeah, they would need, the Cavs would need to make some serious adjustments against that, because those two together in the pick and roll just would devastate.
And you know how that super hyped Miami crowd would be such a huge home court advantage in the playoffs.
I think they'd get up for a Heat-Cavs series.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, if there was anything that would make them step up, it would be LeBron coming back in a playoff series. Especially if they took one of the first two games in Cleveland.
Which they could very easily do.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, it's a very good team.
Yeah.
Very interesting team. The rest of their roster is really interesting too, because you got guys like, well, I don't know if Tyler Johnson's healthy, but Tyler Johnson shot the hell out of the ball last year, just like out of nowhere.
I think they've done a good job with adding veterans who are going to have, you know, playing smaller roles. Amari obviously can't defend anyone at this point, but I think he can still help a team on the offensive end for sure. And so can, you know, Gerald Green has had low key has had a couple of pretty good years in Phoenix. And they got him for the minimum.
Yeah, I thought they had a great offseason. You could make an argument that given the constraints they had the best offseason because, you know, teams like the Spurs did more, but the Spurs had a lot of ability to do more, and they got guys to, you know, take a lot less than they were worth. Miami was kind of between a rock and a hard place and just nailed it.
Right, because like I think the what they ended up doing with Dwayne Wade was perfect because you don't want to give him like a long-term, you know, Kobe type of contract that's going to hamstring them because obviously they're going to be trying to chase Kevin Durant next year. But, you know, do right by him in the short term. You know, give him the 1 year, $20 million. That kind of makes up for the money that he left on the table by opting out last summer and by taking the pay cut for the few years with LeBron there. But then, you know, I think the idea is that going forward they'll be like, okay, you know, we took care of you. Now, you know, we want to bring in, you know, more stars. So if you could take less now, like I think he might be more open to that now that they met him halfway this time. So I think they handled that whole situation really well.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the idea of if they get Durant, obviously that changes everything for them. But of what they would want to, where Hassan, I guess the right way to articulate this is where Hassan Whiteside is on their, like, theoretical big board of free agents. Because, like, would they rather have Al Horford? You know, would they rather, you know, where would they like to go with
him? Oh, God.
I would feel so much, I mean, I feel more comfortable giving, I mean, they're both going to get the max. I would feel a lot more comfortable giving it to Al Horford, even with his age and his injury history. He's just so much more of a sure thing. You know what he is. Whiteside, you know, Whiteside had a great year last year, but he still has kind of off the court, like, you know,
he got benched against the Wizards. Like I was covering it. It was Wizards Heat, and he got benched because I can't remember if it was that he was not trying, like not getting back on defense, or he spat back at the coaches or something. You know, like, it was something, and he got.
And he's also had a couple of things where like he, you know, had some like hard fouls against guys that were kind of dirty. He has, and you know, like Wade called him out for it one time, like saying that like he was like letting the team down. I forget what his exact wording was, but Wade kind of called him out publicly. So he's definitely rehabilitated his career, but he's not like a model citizen as of now. So as long as the production stays where it was last year, I think he will be one of their priorities. But if there's any more of those slip ups or the production slips, I think especially considering that they would have to go into their cap space to re-sign him because of the weird early bird thing. I think they would feel a lot more comfortable going for, you know, something that's a little bit more of a sure thing like Al Horford.
Horford and Bosch together is terrifying, and I'm very upset that you brought up this potentiality.
can we talk about the idea of Horford going to the Bulls? Because I remember I listened to the podcast that you did with Nate last week, and then you and I talked about this a little bit, and I think that's really interesting. I don't think it's likely to happen, but that...
Yeah, I mean, well, so that gets into something that I've wanted to talk about and probably will on the podcast in a longer thing, which is the amount of money is about to spike so high that I think there's a really real possibility that certain guys are going to take, like guys who want this, are willing to going to take less than they're worth to make themselves happier. And I could totally see that happening with Noah and Horford, just because I from what I've heard, they still have a really good relationship.
Yeah.
And Horford, that kind of gets him a lot of what he wants. You know, he likes to, it sounds like, similar to LaMarcus Aldridge, that he would, you know, relish playing a little bit less, you know, right at the basket and getting banged around a lot. And the Bulls are obviously a good team. So, like, if they could figure out a way to make it work, that would be crazy good. I mean, that would be... If you can run a three-man front court rotation, let's say conceptually, of Horford, Noah, and Mirotic, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if your goal is to win a title, I think that's as good a way to do it as they're going to have, assuming they're not going to get Durant, because I don't think they are.
I think they're the only team who's not going after him.
I don't think they're even
going. It's a 2019 race right now.
You honestly don't think they're going after him?
No.
I think they'll I don't think they have, well. I don't think they have any realistic expectations.
I think they'll get a meeting. I think they'll call. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think they're even going to get a meeting, though.
No, they'll call. They'll check in. Maybe he's always wanted to be a Bull, but you know, like I don't think they have any
Nor should they have any realistic expectations of getting him. But I mean,
their free agency next year is going to be interesting because I it's so hard to get a read on what Noah is because you know I mean the thing with Noah his whole career has been like, he's not a big guy. He's 6'11". He's not like a physically overpowering guy. He's just, you know, he's been able to, you know, be more athletic.
He's listed at 230 and he's not that.
Yeah. Once that athleticism goes, I think we kind of saw what happened this year. And, I mean, maybe he has a bounce-back year this year if he's, you know, been able to actually train normally during the regular season. I mean, during the off-season and not have to, you know, be rehabbing from knee surgery. But, you know, I can't imagine he's going to be anything close.
He's also in his 30s.
Right, he's in his 30s. I can't imagine he's going to be close to a max player next year in free agency. I wonder what he's going to get. Is he going to get like $10 million a year in the new cap? Is that going to be enough?
Well, I think if teams are offering him something in that range, then you start to get into the fun questions of would he take less for the right team or for the right situation. And I mean, because if you're deciding at 10, then like choosing 6 or 7 is a lot more palatable than if you're at 15.
Yeah,
right.
The other crazy, crazy hypothetical that I've never talked about on the show is, let's say, conceptually, Kevin Durant said, you know where I want to go? I want to go to Cleveland. Like, what kind of an offer? Like, if Cleveland then went, okay, like, so because the crazy part about that is they'd have to get under the tax to do it, because you can't sign and trade, you can't acquire a guy by sign and trade. So it's like, okay, would they be willing to basically trade all the guys they re-signed this summer to get Kevin Durant?
I don't know why you wouldn't be.
That would be so much fun. But
so you're talking about Love, Shumpert, assuming they keep Tristan, then Tristan. Yeah, I mean, I think you have to do that. But
yeah, I'd have to run the numbers to see if it's even, like, tangentially possible, but it's just one of those fun things to think about.
You blew my mind there.
This is what the offseason does to us.
This is what being a CBA nerd does. I think about something and I go, is this like basically what I think about sometimes because I have an Excel sheet with everybody's salaries is I think about, oh, that would be fun. Is it possible? And so that's when I've done a series of pieces for Warriors World about how the Warriors could get Durant. Because it's totally
that I could actually see happening.
Oh, it's actually, depending on what they do with their extensions with Barnes and Azealia, it's actually very possible. I'm not saying it's likely because I have no idea what Kevin Durant wants. But
why are we talking about the Bulls going after Kevin Durant when they're obviously going after future Bull Anthony Davis, according to everyone on Bulls Twitter?
Oh God,
2020 plan. Let's get it.
I would like to formally apologize.
You gotta come home.
I would like to formally apologize to Pelicans fans that when I wrote a piece on Real GM talking, which I still believe that he should have taken the qualifying offer, I did not mean that necessarily to say that he was going to leave specifically to go to the Bulls, because apparently Bulls Twitter started talking about that partially, not mostly because of my piece, but they used that as rocket fuel for a conversation they were already having.
Anytime anyone mentions Anthony Davis, Bulls Twitter will just appear. He should go back to Chicago and just like disappear into the ether.
That actually gets into something that would, considering your guys' connection, how do you quantify Derrick Rose's value in terms of his next negotiations?
It depends a lot on what, because he's got 2 years left in his deal. I think ideally what the Bulls would want to say to him, and we'll see how his people react to this. This is going to be a fun thing to see unfold over the next couple of years. But, you know, I mean, obviously, I think at this point, he's worth more to the Bulls than he's worth to any other team. I think that's pretty fair to say, because he's from here. He's like, you know, the local success story, even with all his injuries and stuff. And the point guard position is so deep. I can't imagine there's going to be another team, unless he has his last 2 years in his contract, he gets back to playing at like an MVP type of level with no injury concerns. And, you know, you're talking about something that's two variables that I think are probably pretty unlikely to happen. But I think the ideal thing for the Bulls is if they were to decide, you know, okay, look, we gave you the max while you were recovering from knee surgery for 2 of the years. So, you know, we didn't get a lot of value out of that max. So do you think we stuck with you this whole time. Do you think you could do us a solid and maybe take a little bit less on your next contract? I mean, we'll see how Rose's people react to that if they bring it up, but you know.
Because if there's one attribute I'll give to the Bulls, it's sticking with Derrick Rose. Yep, totally.
Yeah, they don't even want to bring in a backup who can challenge him.
Yeah, but they would have had so many. They could have had so much. Like, and that's the thing. It's not even just, you know, what they could have done, because like, he wouldn't have had much trade value during, you know, the seasons where he was injured. But there was no, like, you know, it was all from the top down, and I was here for the last couple of years while this was all going on. Thibodeau always had his back. His teammates always had his back. The organization was always saying, you know, we don't want to rush him back. We want him to get healthy. Like, they've had his back the whole time. So I think if they've gone this far, and especially if this lawsuit turns out to be nothing, I think this is probably not the appropriate place to get into the details of that. But, you know, assuming if that turns out to not be a long-term thing that sticks around, you know, I think at this point they're kind of just in it for the long haul with him, and he's going to get more money even if he doesn't get another max deal, because I don't think he's really a max player at this point. No. I think he's probably going to get more from the Bulls than he would get from any other team just because of the history they have there.
Well, and so he'll start his next contract at 29, which is, I mean, it's a little, you means the back end of that contract will probably be shaky for a point guard, but, and we don't know even, you know, relative to his prime. I mean, theoretically, most guys, if they're, you know, healthy, their prime is, I like to think of it as 27, like 26 to 27 to 29 or so. And, you know, so they could get some value out of the first couple of years of that, especially because guys like Butler will still be on the right side of everything, and Mirotić too. But yeah, it's hard to quantify with him, mostly unlike a lot of guys, not because if we don't know, you know, his talent level, but we have no idea what he is right now.
Yeah. What's really interesting, what do you guys think about this whole thing that Jimmy's been talking about this summer about wanting to be a point guard and wanting to handle the ball a little bit more? And for the record, I don't really think there's a lot to these rumors that they don't get along or that they can't play together. I think that's pretty overblown. But
I think it's fair to assume there was some friction with how...
Sure, but it's like okay, right. I mean, there was
how do we play together?
Some friction, but it's like okay, you guys they don't really hang out off the court. Like, they don't have to be best friends and hang out. But the thing is, nobody's like that with Derek. He has his people. I don't think any of his teammates really are that close to him off the court. Even the guys that have been with him for a long time, like Joakim. That's just how Derek is. I think a lot of that is kind of overblown. But, you know, getting away from that for a second.
I think it was almost him being a little facetious by just like, because he handled the ball so much in the pick and roll, because Heinrich couldn't sometimes, because Brooks would just shoot. I mean, Brooks runs these pick and roll, he just didn't. So I think part of that was him sort of just remarking on the fact that he really did run, he initiated a lot of sets, handled the ball a lot in the pick and roll, and just ended up being sort of the lead guard. So, you know, I think that's more just him kind of pointing out the obvious than him actually thinking he's a point guard.
I'm not bringing this up to say it was a shot at Rose or anything, because I don't think it was.
No.
What was, but what's interesting, because when he said that, I looked this up, and they actually, every time they played Rose with another point guard, they had a positive net rating. And, you know, in some cases, whether it was with Heinrich or with Brooks. And, you know, so I think, you know, if Butler, you know, improves, he's already a pretty good ball handler. If he improves his passing a little bit, if he can actually play point guard, you know, that would ease a lot of the burden on Rose. You know, you can have them sort of trade off, and that would just kind of give them another wrinkle. I kind of feel like that could be an interesting thing for them to explore.
Yeah, I agree. I think that they can both those guys can play on and off the ball. And that's something that I've liked for years, is just having multiple guys that can do it but don't feel like they have to. And I think the league is going more that direction. And so for what I would say with Jimmy is, if he wants to do it, if he can, if he shows that he has the capability, then you start to give him more freedom. And when he starts to mess it up, then you pull the reins back. I mean, I think
the thing you have to worry about is whether Rose playing off the ball translates into Rose shooting more threes, because that's kind of been a thing the last couple of years where he's felt like he can shoot threes, and clearly the numbers show that he can't.
Yeah, that's true.
Hey, he was a good three-point shooter in the playoffs this year. You leave him alone. No,
he was a great three-point shooter on buzzer beaters that were banked.
What did he shoot? Let me look up what he shot. He actually shot fairly well, because he shot a lot. He shot a lot of spot-up threes.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the numbers with him. He might be a guy, it's entirely possible, this is just me, just from when I've watched the Bulls, that he could be a much better spot-up shooter from range. Then
his problem is that sometimes a play will break down, he won't, you know, or he'll get something will be blocked off, and he'll just decide, well, I should dribble five times, then shoot this three. That'll work. Yeah. And it just is terrible.
Yeah, because I could totally see him as one of those guys. You know, another player who's like that is Kyrie. Kyrie's spot up percentages are ridiculous. Like, he's really good at it. It's just that he doesn't shoot them as high a proportion of his looks as he could, partially because he has the ball in his hands all the time. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that per se. It's just that you need to adjust it.
348 from three in the playoffs this year. And that's considering I'm pretty sure he missed his last 8 or 9. So
yeah, and so
he's fine.
And that's also what makes Stephen Curry just ridiculous, is that he can take those shots that everybody else shouldn't take, and he makes them.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, he's the best. He's the best off the dribble 3-point shooter in the history of the league, which is
not
useful.
God, his on off is 23.7 in the playoffs. Rose. Yeah, he wasn't even that good.
Well, and I mean, but that I think a lot of that goes back to the idea that, you know, that they had their bench was so flawed.
No, that's exactly what it goes back to. It's that's less him being that good and more Heinrich and Brooks just being abysmal in the playoffs. They were just terrible. Like, they couldn't play them without him on the floor.
Yeah, I think it would be obviously they don't have the guys to do it, but something that I've harped on with the Warriors a little bit, though it's less true now than it used to be, is the idea of having a starting point guard who would do really, really well against other teams' backups just because he's so much better than them, to have a defensive-minded backup and then just play the defensive-minded backup against the other team's starter sometimes. So what that would do if Jimmy Butler really wants to take a larger role is you say, oh, like, the guy for this, if you want to think about it, is Patrick Beverley. You know, so you let Jimmy Butler do it. You have Patrick Beverley take the other team's, let's say Kyrie. You have Patrick Beverley just, like, ruin Kyrie's life for 5 minutes. And then you play Rose, so he still gets starter minutes, but you just tilt his minutes around a little bit so he plays a higher proportion of them against backups just to get him going.
Yeah.
I think that would be awesome for them. I think but instead their backup point guard is
the idea
Brooks.
Of Patrick Beverley as a backup in general, it's too good an idea for them.
So
that just wouldn't happen.
Yeah, well, but the downside of Beverley, why you don't want him playing with backups is that the thing that he does the worst, in my opinion, of the things that he does is running an offense.
Yeah.
So, like, if you can play him with James Harden or with somebody who's capable of running an offense, I think you do that. But it's just a kind of an unusual way of thinking about rotations. But I think with guys who have really predominant characteristics like that, I mean, you could say the same thing with Sean Livingston with the Warriors if you wanted to, but like he's a little bit different just because his defense has changed over the last couple of years just because, you know, he is what he is with his knee injuries and everything else. He's still a very good player, but it's frustrating to me that it seemed like the Bulls they limited themselves just by having a guy who you can't trust with that role. And that's a bad thing. If you can't play Aaron Brooks with your starters and he's your backup, then you're in double trouble because that means that you don't want you're extra hurt if Derrick Rose has to miss time.
It's just a very foolish way of building a lineup, building a team.
So
the only other thing I had to add was that Bucks now have the best jerseys in the division. Giles Mike Randall.
The best jerseys what?
In the division.
Best active jerseys?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean the Pacers old jerseys are better, but
Flojo's?
The Flojos are fantastic.
Yeah, those are great.
Well, did you guys see that the Bulls are going to bring back for their Hardwood Classics night? They're going to bring back the jerseys from Jordan.
The cursive font ones,
Chicago cursive.
That's
font.
True. Those might be better.
Those are gorgeous too.
Those are my favorite. Probably my favorite jerseys of all time.
Yeah, some people would probably argue there's certain Pistons ones that are nice, not the ones with the horse on it, but the Isaiah ones.
Whoa! What are you saying about what jerseys with the horse on them?
Do you like those?
I like all bad 90s jerseys, except for the Red Sonics.
Wait, what? Oh. I don't even think I remember the Red Sonics. I might have blocked those out.
Well, remember, because, the ones after the... It was just an alternate, but remember,
The
ones that were, their late 90s, early 2000s green ones, but red.
They had, such a heavy accent that you thought it was the primary color.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right. Though, those are terrible.
They're not even interestingly bad.
Like, it's always kind of frustrating to me when a team has an unusual primary color or color combination, when they move away from that, is it's like, you know, you had this corner and you did a good job with it. Don't move away from that.
What do you guys think about the Hawks? Because I don't hate their jerseys as much as I did when they first announced them.
At Summer League,
they had them all, in these displays.
I hated them. I still hate them.
I think they look a lot better on people than
but
they did.
But other than the sleeves, the Buzz City Hornets jerseys are unbelievably beautiful.
Yeah.
You
have to think the sleeves are going to stop being a thing once Nike.
I am conditionally in on the Hawks jerseys as long as they don't actually mix and match like they said they might, which would just be the worst idea and it would look horrible.
Wait! Mix and match like wearing one pair of
shorts.
Yeah,
they said they could do it.
That's terrible. Why would you do that?
Yeah, it's the worst idea. It would look horrible. But
I don't like the whites. I don't like the whites at all. But the blacks.
I don't like the
reds.
I don't like the Volt green or whatever it is. Get rid of that, and it might be better.
The Hawks are another team. They're a team that has had multiple different color combinations that work. Because the old Pistol, I have a Pistol Pete Maravich Hawks jersey that's really nice.
The Hawks jerseys are better than the Clippers New jerseys. I'll say that.
Well, I think a literal trash bag is better than the Clippers.
Sixers New jerseys are amazing.
The Clippers mascot, by the way. Do you guys see that?
I have already. Well, first of all, your idea is better than my idea, but. Your idea was that they should just have the old Pierre the Pelican, which is better. My idea is, so it was a kind of a real blast from the past, but Stetson University used to have it. I think they were the Stetson Hats or Stetson Hatters, because that's what a Stetson is. And, and so their mascot was a giant hat. Not like a hat with googly eyes, I think, primarily. It was just a giant hat. A giant boat that is just a giant boat, to me, would be perfect. It doesn't say anything. It doesn't interact with the kids. It's just a giant boat.
Why not just Steve Ballmer?
There you go. Maybe they have two mascots. Maybe they resurrect the original Pierre the Pelican, and they resurrect the Brooklyn Knight. Just all both at once. Make them a crime-fighting duo who rise in a Clipper ship.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
I'm gonna tweet that before the podcast goes up, so I stake my intellectual property for that.
Feel free. I withdraw all rights to trademark on that.
Who else said New Jersey?
Except animation. I get animation rights.
Never should have given him animation rights. Hey, look, a Sheagle. Who all has New Jerseys? The Nuggets technically have New Jerseys.
Yeah.
It looks fine. It looks like...
Sixers ones are nice.
Yeah, the Sixers ones are great. Yes. Toronto's look alright.
Yeah, I like Toronto's.
And then the rest are just like alternates.
Well,
like
Toronto, the Toronto, you have to put an asterisk next to Toronto's because they ripped off the Nets by having a rapper introduce them. So
they have a circular logo.
They're tainted.
Stealing from Brooklyn.
Brooklyn
invented that concept.
They had the all I'm saying is that the Nets jerseys have names on the front and numbers on the back, and player names on the back, and then the Raptors jerseys.
The Raptors are playing in an indoor stadium with
Steelers on the player name on the back. I'm not saying that they were consciously ripping off the Nets. I'm just saying
they're playing in an indoor stadium. I mean, come on, you're ripping off intellectual property.
They're playing basketball. Like you can't be playing basketball. I mean, the Nets
exist.
The basketball team. Anybody else who's playing basketball, like.
Can we have a short conversation on the Raptors black and gold jerseys? Because I think those could be pretty nice too.
I've seen enough of them yet, but yeah, I like them. I'm looking at the identity update thing, that thing that leaked a while ago.
I love the idea that literally, I think that they have to be glad that Drake handled the Meek Mill thing as well as he did, because that could have been embarrassing if Meek Mill had somehow won that beef, which, you know, is as difficult as that is to imagine, but if that had happened,
has been Kevin Durant on the Bulls.
Right, there you go. But if that had happened, and then the Raptors are like stuck with these uniforms that were designed by Drake, and they're like having Drake as his whole. Are either of you guys going to Toronto for All Star?
I'm considering it. I've heard very good things. I'd like to go, but we just have to figure out what the timing.
Because I'm just assuming that the entire halftime entertainment for the entire weekend is just going to be one long Drake concert, which I'm not even mad at.
Well, see.
I forgot that the Thunder had these garbage-looking orange alternates.
Oh my god, no.
That's right, those their new ones. Yeah, god, those are... Why would you...
The Pistons have the silver ones. Which look,
the Thunder just need... I'm sorry, the Thunder need to just tear down their entire...
They need a full rebrand.
The Thunder's
a fine name.
Well,
I actually think they need to get rid of the Thunder name. I hate... And this is like a personal thing of mine. I hate singular names. The Heat.
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
Okay, here's my rule on it. If you have to struggle to think about what a player on that team would be called,
I'm a Thunder. Like that sounds stupid. Yeah. I'm a Heat. I'm a Magic.
I like that the Jazz have sort of preempted it by just going with Jazzman, which is better.
Which is bad, too, but it's less bad. It's less bad. Also, they should not be the Utah Jazz. That should go back to
That's...
Well, okay, but the Lakers shouldn't be the Los Angeles Lakers. That should go back to Minneapolis.
No, if you win a title in your new place before the name is reverted, you can opt to keep it. If you haven't yet won a title, the other city should
the
be able
to take
it. The
problem is, if they go back to the New Orleans Jazz, and that, then, you know, the Pelicans are not a thing anymore, which would make me sad.
No, then Utah gets the original Pelican.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
Orleans Pelicans is a very good
team. The other sleeper with that, a team that we already talked about, is the Clippers. The Clippers are, it's close enough geographically that people don't really think about it. Also, I learned this when I made a joke during the semifinals, that people don't know what a Clipper is. But the Clippership's are in San Diego. They're not in L.A., and they always were. I mean, I bought a San Diego Clippers hat over the summer just because it's awesome, because very few people think of it. But I think that, like, it is frustrating to me when you have those kind of anachronistic nicknames. Not that doesn't bother me nearly as much as the non-plurals, or the you can't summarize what a guy is. It would be so much weirder to say that you're a member of the Heat than even that you're a Wizard, and Wizard is unbelievably stupid anyway.
You're a Wizard, John Wall.
I've started calling, anytime the Wizards and the Magic play each other, I've started calling it the Quidditch Cup.
A lot of hardwood classics this year are interesting. Dallas is wearing those green, they're all green uniforms again, which are choice. The city jerseys
are always. Aren't the Mavericks having those new Skyline alternates?
Yeah, they're fine. Line?
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
There was this one jersey from that contest, because I remember that contest. There was this one jersey that I just loved. And it didn't even make the final round of selection for that contest.
Yeah.
And I was so mad.
It always happens.
Do you remember the one I was talking about?
I remember liking a lot of them. The Kings baby blue ones bring back.
Oh, those are fire. Those are fire.
Yeah, those are great.
Yeah, those should be their primaries.
Yeah, some variation of that.
Yeah, I mean, because also it is ridiculous to me that, I mean, I guess Denver has it in there now, but I went to UCLA, so I have a clear bias towards light blue, but it's such a nice color for jerseys, and it's really an underutilized space in terms of professional basketball.
Yeah.
Almost any team would look nice in that kind of a jersey. Like the Clippers had it for a very short period of time. They had those light blue throwbacks, and they were, I mean, I didn't like the design of them, but the color was good because they had sleeves, and sleeve jerseys are terrible. But then they just seeded that back. They just seeded that landscape back. Like they had it. The other team that should have those colored jerseys is Miami, which I actually fully support them going after some weird ideas, because if any team is going to do some weird color choices, it should be a Miami team.
Well, the Miami jerseys have been really interesting the last few years. I think
they haven't really
done it since LeBron left, but they used to have a bunch of weird alternates. Like they had all those different monochrome ones. They had black, red, green. They had a weird green one, but they had black, red, and white, just monochrome jerseys. I love those. I like those Miami Floridians throwbacks.
Those are great.
Yeah.
You guys see the Miami Vice concept that Mickey Arison put on his Instagram? I think those are kind of cool.
I didn't see the pictures, but I heard the idea. Yeah, I think they have so much real estate that they can use, and they have complete ownership over it. So you can just find something that works. Also, they should be able to play in leisure suits just because that would be the greatest thing ever.
The one I'm forgetting, I don't want to leave them out, are the Hickory High Pacers jerseys, which could be terrible looking. I'm not entirely sure how they're going to work.
Who?
Pacers are wearing Hickory High jerseys.
Are they sponsored by Ian Levy?
Apparently, yeah.
Shout out Ian Levy.
Shout out Ian. Excellent. Excellent writer.
Now, he's very excited about it, but no, they are. They're wearing them.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. I think they're cool. I also don't have a really big attachment to that movie, so I don't really have the nostalgia value of it. But they
I don't. But
it's frustrating to me because the Pacers have so many awesome old jerseys that
they do.
Just wear.
They should just go back to the FloJo's full time.
Yep, I would completely.
The FloJo's are great. The ABA era Pacers jerseys are great.
They have so many good jerseys.
They have at least four that I can think of that are legit top 30 or 40 jerseys that any team has worn in the last 30 years that they could wear. And instead they
Pistons
wear things
need,
that
the Pistons need a redesign. They need to go back to the Isaiah era. Their current ones are just bland.
Yeah.
And so the Magic ones are the Magic's current ones are terrible.
They need it.
Well, that goes along. I think Sean, you and I talked about this at the finals. My thing that I think almost every single NBA team has a better jersey that they have worn than the ones they're wearing
now. Why do the Magic ever go away from the 90s pinstripes?
Maybe once every 5 years you do one season with something different and then you go back. Just to somewhere else.
Well, let's think. Who? Yeah, I mean, you could say the Lakers. The Celtics don't really count.
Teams that have had the same jersey for 20 years.
But the Lakers, this is not the best Lakers jersey that's ever existed.
No, correct. It's not.
And they're fine. They're pretty good, but...
Yeah.
They're not as good as Drop Shadow.
I encourage anybody who is listening to this who has a strong opinion on Twitter, please give me examples of teams that are wearing the best jerseys they've ever worn, because I honestly think that list is less than five.
It's Milwaukee.
Well, which teams would even be on it?
Milwaukee.
What's even the five? I don't even think there are five.
I mean, so depending on how you count the whole Charlotte thing.
No, I think you have to. I think you have to measure the current now that the Charlotte Hornets. I think you have to measure them against the
Brooklyn is in the conversation, though. I love if we're continuing the history. Some of those old ABA jerseys were awesome.
Yeah, the Brooklyn ones.
You keep seeing concepts for their current color scheme with a stripe with a star pattern on one side that would just be fantastic.
Yeah,
you could say Philadelphia. Honestly,
yeah, Philadelphia.
Just, like, really good.
They had some awesome jerseys. Was it in the late 80s?
They've had some great jerseys. These are pretty good.
The ones that they had when Barkley was first there, with the swoosh and the stripes. You know the one I'm talking about, the stars.
Those are good.
Nope, the Wizards. I was gonna say the Wizards, but nope.
No.
Nope. Their 70s ones were way better.
But some of these are reimaginings of those jerseys, so you could count them.
No, but they're still worse. Like the Nuggets reimagining of their old jersey is worse than the old jersey.
Maybe Portland, but I think the Walton.
No, I think the Blazers' best. I think the Blazers' best jerseys were the early '90s.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, those are good.
Yeah, and another one like that.
Rockets.
Why haven't the Suns ever gone back to the Barkley era ones?
They did those. They did that.
They did them sleeved.
No.
Oh, they wore throwbacks once. Yeah,
they went back like 2 years ago during the year that Michael Beasley was there. They had the black alternates.
Well, I'm not. I guess I should clarify. I don't mean this alts. I mean this primaries.
Oh, I don't know. And by the way, the Suns jerseys from like the 2000s, from before their current ones, those are the worst jerseys in NBA history. That's my pick for that.
They're pretty bad.
What about, was it like those Mavericks ones that were silver? Like the, like, shiny silver? Somebody had like...
They only wore those in like two preseason games though, right?
The really shiny, pretty much all the really shiny jerseys are just the worst.
I used to always, and I'm kicking myself for not buying one, but I used to always, like in the 2000s, I used to always see like on clearance at any, you know, Champ Sports or whatever store you want to name, the Gilbert Arenas Wizards jersey with it was the gold.
The gold and black, yeah.
Okay, so the Suns are the worst, like, primary jerseys of all time? Because I can agree with that.
Yes.
Because, like, you're neglecting, if you're saying the worst that anyone's ever worn, you're neglecting, like, the camo Spurs jerseys.
Well, anything camo is automatically the worst.
Just garbage.
Full respect to the troops, just camo jerseys
are
terrible.
Shout out to the troops. I almost think it's disrespectful to the troops to...
Because they're
turn,
so bad.
...turn their uniforms into just, like, a caricature of...
Except that I'm fully in support of if, like, Army ever wanted to like wear camo jerseys, I think that would be kind of great.
Right, but like just an NBA team just being like, hey, you know, we're going to salute the troops. I feel like there are other ways to do it.
Shout out to the troops.
However, if the Spurs under David Robinson had worn jerseys that looked like Navy uniforms, that would have been kind of cool.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah.
What about, have the Grizzlies ever had better uniforms? So, I mean, their Vancouver ones were abysmal.
Well, no, the original Vancouver Grizzlies were the best.
The logo was good, but the jerseys were not good.
I think this is probably their best jersey.
Yeah.
This probably is.
That's a low bar. I mean, their jerseys aren't bad, but it's just like they've never had a sweet one.
I love the lettering on their jerseys.
Yeah.
And the numbering. I love the font.
I like that we went in this direction, because you guys are actually two very knowledgeable people about this.
Yeah. This is what a lot of our conversations.
Oh, are the Spurs in there? At least they're in the conversation, right? I don't think they.
Yeah,
like their ABA ones were nice,
it's
but
basically the same jersey. The Gervin ones were good.
I like the '80s Jazz and the '90s Jazz better than the current Jazz, but the current Jazz are so much better than like the early 2000s.
Oh, how great would it be if the Utah Jazz allowed the New Orleans to, even though they're keeping the Pelicans' name, to wear the old New Orleans Jazz uniforms. Because those were just... Basically, I have this theory that Pete Maravich just went wherever his jerseys would look awesome. It
was
like,
that's
everywhere
what I would
ever...
do if I was an NBA player. I would just be like, I want to go to the Warriors or the...
It's insane that you can't say the Warriors are wearing their best jerseys, even though they're wearing...
They have the best
even though they're wearing amazing jerseys.
even close to the city jerseys.
No, no. The Knicks, if you consider it, I really like the Knicks jerseys right now.
Yeah, the Knicks jerseys are fine. They're better than they were in the early 2000s when they had the black on the sides. I didn't like
that.
Yeah,
the black on the sides is just bad.
Are you guys with me that the city jerseys are the best jerseys in professional basketball history?
Probably. Probably.
I think it's between those and the Rainbow Nuggets.
Rainbow Nuggets.
Rainbow Nuggets are pretty great, but no, I don't think they're in. I don't think they're in the conversation. I think it's the city jerseys. And
I have a lot of personal attachment to the cursive font Bulls, but even then, they're not as interesting as the city jerseys. So,
yeah.
The Bulls regular are pretty solid. I mean, what about the?
They're
Bulls?
Good. They're good.
Are the Bulls wearing the best jerseys ever?
No,
well,
they're script
not,
ones.
They're not wearing the cursive font jerseys.
Yeah, the cursive ones are their best ones.
Imagine if the Bulls and Warriors play each other this year wearing the cursive font and city jerseys. Because they're both on their. They're both on the Hardwood Classic list.
Oh, I really hope that happens. That's an ESPN game. The one here is an ESPN game. I really hope that happens.
That'd be probably the best jersey combination possible in the sport.
Yeah, I don't think they would mesh too well color-wise, but just two beautiful jerseys on the same court. Also, if the Warriors don't go to the city jerseys when they move to San Francisco, whenever that ends up happening, I'm just going to be angry the whole time. Like, I feel like that's the reason, because they deliberately...
Well, have they said what they're going to do with the name? Are they going to stay Golden State Warriors, or are they going to go back to San Francisco Warriors?
It's not official yet, but there have been indications that they are intending to switch when the switch happens.
So they're going to be the San Francisco Warriors.
Correct. That is my interpretation. I have not heard that confirmed by anybody on the team. I think there have been a couple like loose reports out there, but it also makes complete sense, especially because there's lots of history with that name. If they move to San Francisco and become the San Francisco Warriors and do not go back to the city jerseys, I'm just going to be belligerently angry. I feel like people should pick it. Like that, and I don't even think this is actually a good topic for the two of you guys too. I'm really frustrated that so many teams are really open to wearing remakes or whatever of the old jerseys when just making exactly the same or substantially similar jerseys with the new players' names would sell really well. Like, it's
I'm pretty sure there's a rule about that, though.
Is there really?
Yeah.
I think the teams that have done the best with this idea, bringing the Bucks again, taking some of the design decisions of those jerseys but changing them to the point where they're not just remakes. Like the piping down the side on these Bucks jerseys is obviously supposed to be a callback to the 80s Bucks jersey, but they're not the same jersey. I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, it's at the very least they should sell the jersey. Well, the Blazers did that for a while.
I can't even imagine how many jerseys they would sell of like do they even sell like the old awesome Lakers jerseys with Kobe's name on it? They could sell.
Yeah, you know I've seen those. I've seen that. I see like the blue cursive like Minneapolis era Lakers, because I think they've probably worn those as throwbacks. I've seen those. I've definitely seen the drop shadow.
Again, at Summer League, you will see every Kobe jersey conceivable.
Yeah, that's true. But I was thinking like a City Curry jersey, I'm sure would sell insanely well.
The City Curry. Yeah. I mean, I don't really buy jerseys anymore because I can't wear them, and it's just kind of a waste of money. But I would probably buy the City Curry jersey.
Yeah, that would be... Also, any team that goes with those... I despise gray as a primary color in jerseys. Like those horrible Celtics ones?
Yeah. Oh,
well, the Celtics should just never have alternates of any kind. I've never liked the Celtics alternates that have the black lettering.
Those are bad.
If you're the Celtics...
Yeah,
if you're the
Celtics...
This is the
same one that has like green and gold. They're okay.
No, I don't like those either. Celtics should be like the Yankees and just never have any kind of...
What about your opinions on the Jazz Mountain jerseys?
Oh, I love those. I love them.
I kind of used to hate them for some reason. But I always liked them more than the shit they went to afterwards.
Well, no, see, yeah. I like the ones they had before that, but I think I like those more than what came after. Like, you know, the ones that are...
Horrible.
The ones they based this new look off of?
Yeah.
Like the...
Yeah, I like those.
Yeah, I was looking at... One thing I know, I was going to try to look through it with the Jazz is, like, I think they right now, like, when they have purple on the white jerseys that have purple as the accent color, but they have the numbers are green, I really don't like that. But if they made the numbers purple and then kept green as, like, a deep accent color, I think that, which is what they did originally. But then it's the same jersey. It's probably why they didn't do that.
Yeah.
We have to think that the sleeves are going to go away once Nike gets the apparel. This is a controversial opinion, but I liked the Brooklyn Nets gray-sleeved alternate.
Oh, the Brooklyn Dodgers tribute ones?
I like that because at least like it conceptually made sense. Like, we're going to make them That's like the only one where it's like I understand why it makes sleeves because it's like a baseball jersey.
Okay, but here's my point. If you're going to do that, then use the awesome script Dodger style and don't make them gray. Make them white. Like Dodgers, yeah. Dodgers,
white would look so much better.
I hate the Dodgers, but their white uniforms are stunning. Like if you basically made a basketball equivalent of that jersey, I wouldn't wear it, but I would like it. As much fun as this is, I shall let you guys go.
This was fun.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
Thanks so much to Sean and Brian for taking the time to come on. You can read Sean Hyken at Bleacher Report. He's their lead Bulls writer and at NBC Sports. And you can follow him on Twitter at Hyken, H-I-G-H-K-I-N. Brian writes for Hardwood Paroxysm and Bulls by the Horns. And you can also follow him on Twitter at Cosmis, C-O-S-M-I-S. It was real fun having them on. I have two more of these Division Ones to go, but I've enjoyed doing all of them. And I hope you got something out of it. For feedback, you can always reach out to me at Danny LaRoux is my Twitter handle, DannyLeroux. You can also hit me up on email at daniel.laroux@realgm.com. I have some more pieces on the NBA Utopia concept at Sporting News. I hope to do one on the on-court changes that I'd like, which it might be on Sporting News. I actually don't know where that one's going to roll, but I'm going to do that in the next couple weeks. Wrote a piece on mid-level exceptions for the CBA Encyclopedia at Real GM, and have lots of other, you know, good content. Also did a off-season grades for the Eastern Conference with Nate Duncan on the Dunked On podcast, and we will do Western Conference. It looks like we're going to record over the weekend, so it'll probably come out early next week. And I appreciate all of you guys for following that. Also, now I have a Facebook page, which has all of the material that I put out in various outlets altogether. So if you're interested in it, thank you. And that is about as good a resource as you can have, because I write for a lot of different places, do podcasts for different sites, and, you know, when I guest on something else. So appreciate that. And as always, your input is greatly appreciated, and I read everything and respond to as much as I can, and I really do appreciate it. So thank you so much for taking the time to listen. Take care, and make it a great day.